To everything, there is a season, and a time to every purpose under the heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. Thus it is written in the Scriptures, and thus also it is written in the experience of our daily lives. To everything there is a season. There was a time for me to be president of this organization. That time is no more. A new president now comes to the stage. A new era now begins in the movement. It remains for me to help with the transition and then assume my new role in the organization. What then, at this final banquet, on this last night of my presidency, shall I say to you? What that we have not already jointly discussed and collectively experienced during the past quarter of a century. In articles and speeches, in public pronouncements, and in literally thousands of letters, I have set forth my beliefs and declared my faith in the capacity of the blind and the need for collective action. I have said that what we must have is not pity but understanding, not custody, but opportunity. Not care, but acceptance. I say it still, and this too. I have tried as best I could to match deeds to words, to be not merely an armchair strategist, but a frontline soldier as well. There are scars to prove it, enemies to resent it, and friends to confirm it. Nothing I can say tonight will change the record. In the words of the poet, the moving finger writes, and having writ moves on, nor all your piety nor wit shall lure it back to cancel half a line, nor all your tears wash out a word of it. As president of the Federation, I have always tried to see our movement in broad context, attempting to ease the losses and temper the victories with a sense of perspective. So, on this night, let us talk of history and look to the future, assessing where we are by where we have been and where we're going. In 1940, when the blind came to organize, the situation was as bleak as it could possibly be. It was bright enough to create hope and dark enough to make that hope seem impossible. Barely a handful from seven states met on that day in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, to establish the National Federation of the Blind. In the climate of growing agency control and custodialism, they felt that freedom would not wait, that they must either act then, regardless of their numbers, or risk losing the opportunity forever. The majority they sought, the powerful movement of the organized blind, might never come unless they had the courage to create it and the dream to believe it. They had that courage. They created that dream. And 37 years later, we meet here tonight in our thousands, the strongest force in the affairs of the blind in this nation. It is only when we look back that we realize how far we have come. In 1940, there was virtually nothing. By today's standards, no rehabilitation, no libraries, no opportunity for higher education, no rights for sheltered shop employees, no training for the newly blinded, no money for the elderly, no help for the needy, no jobs in federal civil service, no chance in business, no hope in the professions, no state or federal civil rights protection, no encouragement to venture, and no recognition of dignity or worth. There were only the put-downs and the exclusions, which made of the blind virtually a subhuman species. It was an atmosphere which broke the spirit and quenched the hope and killed the dream. But that was another time, another generation. Whatever else the National Federation of the Blind may have done, one thing is certain. It has helped us understand and made us believe in ourselves, in each other, and in our collective strength. It has also taught us to fight. In short, it has brought us to see that we are, in every modern sense of that word, a minority. Through painful experience, we have learned that our problems come not from our blindness, but from the misconceptions and the misunderstandings of society. Not from inferiority, but public attitudes. Attitudes which we ourselves still too often unwittingly accept and thus do much to make reality. With equally painful experience, we have learned that the professionals in the very public and private agencies established to aid us frequently, instead of helping solve our difficulties, contribute to them. And of course there has been much more, if the Federation had done nothing else but give us these understandings, it would have more than justified its promise. We are now organized, informed, and on the move. We want no strife or confrontation, but we will do what we have to do. We are simply no longer willing to be second-class citizens. They tell us that there is no discrimination, that the blind are not a minority, but we know who we are and we will never go back. With all our advances, we still face serious problems. Let anyone who doubts it look at the Gallup poll taken in January of 1976. It shows that, next to cancer, blindness is the most feared of all human ailments. More than deafness, more than heart disease, more than mental illness, more than any other possible problem. This contrasts sharply with our personal experience. For we know that with training and opportunity, we can reduce blindness to the level of a mere inconvenience. But we also know that custodialism, discrimination, denial of opportunity, and put-downs can make of our blindness a veritable hell, as terrible as it has ever been thought to be. This is why we have organized. It is why the National Federation of the Blind exists, to eliminate the fears, disseminate the truth, and bring new hope to the sighted and the blind alike. With the expanding horde of professionals in the field who must write papers, think up additional services, and find something to do to occupy their time so as to keep their jobs, enhance their prestige, and raise their salaries, it is not surprising that traditional fears and misconceptions are reinforced. The ancient myths and prejudices are absorbed by the professionals from the public and then fed back again in the name of science and expertise, bolstered by computers, sanctified by technology, and financed by government grants. It is a formidable array, but it is the same old lie it has always been. We are not inferiors, and we prove it every day through our personal lives and our individual experience. The public attitudes about blindness manifest themselves in every facet of daily existence. Consider, for instance, an item as simple as a mail order catalog. Such a catalog, called Mail Order USA, or MAUSA, recently came to me with this cover letter. Quote, "I am sure that your members would appreciate learning more about this book, which will help make shopping less of an ordeal. The families of a blind person can send for catalogs of articles the person needs, and in the leisure and quiet of his home, decide what he wants to buy. No more being stampeded by impatient sales clerks." Now, there's a lot of food for thought packed in that brief statement. Are the blind really so frail that we are more likely than others to find shopping an ordeal or be stampeded by sales clerks? And observe, it is not the blind person who is expected to order the catalog, but his family, who will decide for him what he wants to buy. And you will notice, in restful circumstances, as they say, in the quiet of his home. When it comes to cooking and matters related to the kitchen, both the public and the professionals have a field day. An article entitled Arizona Volunteers and Blind Homemakers in Food and Home Notes, a publication issued by the United States Department of Agriculture, says, "Ever wonder what it's like to be blind? How would you boil water safely? That's what it says. Where, one might ask, just where did the Agriculture Department get such ideas? Well, we're not left in doubt. The article goes on to say, arrangements worked out through the American Foundation for the Blind provided expert trainees. Every trainee practiced skills both as a blind learner and a blind teacher. The Arizona episode is not the only experience of the American Foundation with kitchens. The January 24, 1973 Miami Herald reported that the foundation would sponsor 6 workshops for sighted rehabilitation personnel, public health nurses, and county home demonstration agents to teach homemaking techniques to blind persons. Presumably, these foundation-taught personnel would then go into the homes of the blind to teach skills and proper attitudes about blindness. Judge for yourself the level of expectation, the image of blindness, and the probable results from the following statement by Evelyn Berger, home economist, who, according to the article, introduced local women rehabilitation workers to the challenge of darkness. A blind person's kitchen should be simplified as much as possible, she said. Yes. High storage areas should be avoided. Pans used most frequently should be at an accessible level. And get this, if the teacher must leave the room for a minute, leave the person with his hand on something, such as a chair back, for security. That's what they say. The article goes on with this statement. When you return, announce your arrival with a, "Hi, I'm back." Yeah, and to all of that we say, yes, of course pans should be at an accessible level and high storage should be avoided, but no more for the blind than for anybody else. As for that talk about putting the hand of the blind person on the back of the chair for security and cheerfully announcing the teacher's return, that's pure drivel. The sort of thing that makes sensational newspaper reading, perpetuates public misconceptions, and creates high-paying jobs for dull-witted custodians. Under the circumstances, is it any wonder that the following passage appears in the standard advertising literature for the Miromatic pressure cooker? Quote, "Braille books for use by sightless people are available through Miro. These books include the cooking charts, instructions, and 32 recipes. Cooking procedure is not given and must be taught by a sighted person." Yet they tell us that there is no discrimination, that the blind are not a minority, but we know who we are and we'll never go back. Kitchens with their supposed dangers seem to hold a special fascination for those concerned with our welfare. Graduate students at the Illinois Institute of Technology recently designed a special kitchen for the blind to, as they put it, help the sightless achieve greater independence in a vital area of day-to-day living. The September 16, 1976 Los Angeles Times quoted the designers as follows: "Using the ordinary kitchen can be a disaster for a blind person. Oh, there's more, much more in it. All unnecessary kitchen and outside noise should be eliminated or reduced through soundproofing, since blind people use sound to judge their cooking. Well, you got much more in store on this one. They go on to say, the ventilation system should be designed to provide sounds necessary for a blind person's awareness and control. The kitchen design should always allow the user's hands to be as independent of each other as possible to allow better preparation for emergencies." And see how you like this. This is the next part of it. "A rest area should be..." Yeah. You heard it right. Wait just a minute now. Just hold on and listen to this. "A rest area should be provided to combat fatigue." And notice this. See, I like this. They're talking about you and me now. The telephone, the doorbell, and the radio should be located in one area of the kitchen. Work areas should have different textures and raised edges to provide clues for identification of reference points. There's a little more of it. They go on. "Floors should have varied textural surfaces to give blind people awareness of their location." Varied shaped or textured handles should be used for ease of identification. Sinks should have a raised edge with small counter area in front. In addition, the sink might have different depths and or shapes helpful in food preparation and washing. Burners should be placed at the rear of the stove to provide a safe distance between the user and the heated surface. Storage units should be made vertically mobile, eliminating bending and stretching. Electrical outlets should be placed at waist level with large metal plates for ease of locating. The blind person should be encouraged to maintain close body contact with his work area to provide an additional clue to his location. Okay. I remember that appeared in the Los Angeles newspaper, or Los Angeles, I'm told, newspaper. What a kitchen. It would be ludicrously funny if it were not so miserably pathetic and if it had not been seen by millions of readers to confirm and reinforce their notions of our helplessness. And where do you suppose it all came from? Where do you think these graduate students from the Illinois Institute of Technology got their ideas about blindness? Yeah. How did they learn what we needed, what we can do, and who we are? Did they come to the blind themselves?
No.
To the largest organization of blind people in this country, to the National to the National Federation of the Blind with our more than 50,000 members? No. As the newspaper tells us, they went to the Chicago Lighthouse for the Blind. And the Illinois Institute for the Visually Handicapped. Yet, these institutions, the Chicago Lighthouse and its like, sometimes express surprise that we resent them and seek to reform them. We stand at the gates and demand to be heard. The hour is late, and we will not be turned away. We will speak. And they will listen, in peace if we can, in war if we must. We've said it before, we'll say it as often as we have to, we are simply no longer willing to be second-class citizens. We know who we are and we won't go back. Not only are the blind thought to need specially designed kitchens, but special apartments as well. Earlier this year, the New York Times carried the headline, "Apartment Building for the Blind is Planned for Site in Manhattan." The article said, the first apartment building in New York City, designed for the exclusive use of the blind, will be built on a vacant site on West 23rd Street, officials of the Associated Blind Incorporated said yesterday. The nonprofit group is planning a 12-story structure with 205 apartments. It will include textured doorknobs so that each resident will know which room he is entering. An emergency call system in each apartment connected to a central security office, and specially designed kitchens and bathrooms. I don't really say what kind of design they're going to put in the bathrooms. I don't know. Okay. Here's some more of this article. Remember now, this is the New York Times. New York City is taking the lead in accommodations specially designed and equipped for the blind, said the chairman of the City Planning Commission. The apartment will be designed in accordance with new national HUD standards for the blind and handicapped. To add insult to injury, all of this mumbo-jumbo and segregation is done in the name of independence and self-expression. The article ends with a quote from the head of the agency involved. "We believe the blind people should have the right to express themselves," he said. "That's right. Yes," we reply, "but what does self-expression have to do with segregated housing?" That is exactly the ghetto from which we are trying to escape. As with other minorities, segregation of the blind, once begun, does not end with housing. Tom Bozikas recently wrote me as follows. "In the city of Hammond," this is Indiana, "where I reside, we have what is reported to be the world's largest Sunday school. What disturbs me is that this church, the First Baptist Church of Hammond, segregates those with physical and mental limitations from the rest of the parishioners. There is a Sunday school class for the blind, the deaf, the crippled, and the mentally retarded. They also have a separate area in church for the blind, deaf, etc. For example, the blind have a special section where they sit, which is clearly marked, and no one else is allowed to sit there. Even in the area of religion, we are second-class citizens." Tom then asked me the question, "Does this mean that the blind will be placed in a special area before the judgment seat?" Well, of course, I wouldn't presume to say what is the situation there, but whatever the answer to Tom's question may be, at least one person believes that the blind are especially blessed. "Dear sir," a teacher wrote me a few months ago, "I can find no criminal statistics in the annual uniform crime report in which blind people are part. I have assumed for 25 years that blind people cannot become criminals due to this sight limitation." He goes on to write as follows. "I teach a course in the correction and prevention of delinquency and crime. A 26-year investigation of criminal phenomena has confirmed the Bible statement that if ye were blind, you should have no sin, crime, John 9:41. If you have any statistics relative to either delinquency or criminal behavior among the blind, I shall greatly appreciate a review of it. I hope you approve of what I did. By way of answer, I sent him a newspaper headline, 'Blind Man Kills Landlady.'" Oh. Incidentally, I don't know what his reaction was. Speaking of crime, I recently received the following letter. Reasonably healthy and handsome and sterile Caucasian widower and prisoner, inmate, with at least 3 more years to serve before parole, and who is 5 feet 10 inches tall, and who weighs 150 pounds, and who was born on 7 November 1934, would like to make the acquaintance of a blind lady of virtually any age who has never been divorced and who is reasonably secure financially. Oh, my. Well, this man goes on. Here's the rest of his letter. Objects, matrimony, and the mutual happiness of two losers. He continues. You notice here the modesty of this man, the sentence I'm about to read you. He says, "If I cannot please you, blind lady, no man can." Oh, my. There's a little more of it. He says, "The need for your being reasonably secure financially is in line with my intention of having a full-time job of keeping you happy." It goes on, "We can teach each other much. My sanity and intelligence are matters of public record. What have we to lose?" Oh. With a different twist, I received a letter from India not long ago. "Dear Sir, I inquired here through the United States Information Service that your federation deals with blind females in the USA. Please send me the details and photos of the blind females which are unmarried and between age 15 and 25. Yeah. Now, there's an object to this, though. You hear the rest of it. If some unmarried blind females want to marry with the young Indians not blind, then I can help them. Some few young Indians want to marry with the blind American ladies. They want to settle themselves in the United States after their marriage." To be sure, not all of the attitudes about the blind are bad. But the incidents I have mentioned are not isolated exceptions. They occur with monotonous frequency. Consider the following examples. Mela Rubinstein of the famous cosmetics firm, after working with the American Foundation for the Blind to, as she put it, teach unsighted women how to use a simple collection of cosmetics to heighten their self-sense of beauty and psychic security, said, and these are her words, "Nature compensates the blind by giving them a highly developed sense of touch, knowledge of the contours and planes of their faces, and a supremely sensitive sense of smell that easily distinguishes between delicate nuances of fragrance. A release," and I'm sorry Mr. Silky couldn't be here, a release from the Division for the Blind and Physically Handicapped of the Library of Congress last fall said, quote, "Surely no one would dispute the idea that the one music library in the nation serving the entire blind and physically handicapped community should be as good as the best music libraries serving everyone else. There is even some justification for saying that this library should provide better music library services than that available to others. It is a well-recognized fact that music tends to have a greater importance to the blind than to the sighted." Now that's what the Division of the Blind and Physically Handicapped said last fall. When asked by the newspapers why he found it necessary to make demeaning rules for blind vending stand operators, stipulating that they bathe twice daily, obtain dental care at least twice a year, eat a balanced diet, and shampoo frequently, Cleo Dolan, the much-publicized head of the Cleveland Society for the Blind, defended himself by saying, quote, "A blind person has to be almost overly cautious, so we set these guidelines." Mr. Dolan's rules covered everything from when the blind should change their underwear to the requirement that they give 8% of their monthly gross sales to his agency. The federal courts thought so little of the civil rights of the blind that they refused to take jurisdiction. That case, with National Federation of the Blind backing, is now on appeal. Roe International Incorporated, a company that sells vending machines and a company that has been with us here during this convention and for all I know may have a representative at this banquet, nevertheless, apparently saw no impropriety in the following language in one of its brochures. Quote, "Roe International Incorporated and our network of over 40 distributor service centers across the country can provide, one, guidance in developing a profitable vending program, two, training of non-handicapped supervisors in administering the program, three, training of the blind operators to serve and maintain the equipment by specialists in training the blind." Not long ago, I received the following inquiry from a student. "Dear sir, I am doing a research paper for a class. I would like to know how many or what percentage of the blind marry, and if any steps are taken to prepare them for this part of life." I don't know what steps he wanted me to take, but... He went on to say, "Also, what might be the difficulties or advantages of these marriages?" I received the following letter from a blind woman in Connecticut. "I am tired of feeling like a second-class citizen. My most recent frustration occurred when I visited a U.S. post office to apply for a passport. I produced my birth certificate, passport pictures, and completed application. Then the crushing blow. Please put your driver's license number on this line." I replied, "I'm sorry, I don't have one. I'm blind." Though I had numerous credit cards, professional organizations, a social security card, as well as a bank identification card with my picture on it, none would suffice. Finally, my friend who had accompanied me was asked to fill out an affidavit swearing to my identity, which required her name, driver's license, and passport information. An article published by the American Foundation for the Blind discusses what is called a severity rating scale for multiply impaired children, in which different conditions are given a numerical value according to their severity. Light perception, total blindness, or blindness before age 3 is given a severity rating of 10. Mental disorders and retardation are regarded as less severe. In the language of the chart, and this is a quote, an IQ of 49 or observed functioning at a level of one half or less of chronological age, trainable, not educable, add 8. Psychotic, extreme disorder resulting in a loss of contact with reality. Common symptoms are hallucinations and distorted behavior, add 8. In other words, it is 25% worse to be blind than to have an IQ of 49 or be psychotic. And that's the American Foundation for the Blind publication. Not to mention that we have a keener sense of touch and smell than others, that music is more important to us, that we must be told when to change our underwear, that we must have non-handicapped people to supervise us, that our marriage habits are so peculiar as to warrant special study, and that we must have a driver's license or do without a passport. Yet, because of our protests, some people call us militant. In the face of such prejudice, ignorance, discrimination, gross insensitivity, and what can only be called downright insanity, the wonder is that we have behaved with such restraint as we have. In the circumstances, our conduct has been mild to a fault and a model of propriety. But let them wait, we're learning. Not all misconceptions and discriminations are as overt as the ones I've just mentioned. In fact, the majority cloak themselves in glib generalities about how independent and how capable we are. Al Fisher, one of our members who runs a center for the blind in Spokane, recently sent me a perfect example. We were asked, he said, to speak to a high school class on child development here. Very early in our discussion, we asked how they felt about blindness and what they thought blind people could do. Their reaction was that blind people were no different from anybody else and that a blind person could do about anything he wanted. Then we started getting into specifics, and they were skeptical about a number of things. I asked them if they would be willing to hire a blind person as a babysitter. Not one, including the teacher, said they would. I'm wondering if they aren't expressing what they think is a popular position, something with form but no substance. Well, I would say Mr. Fisher sized it up pretty well. Deep down at the gut level, at the place where people feel and live, most of the professionals and the general public still believe we're helpless. It's that simple, and it's that compelling. Some of them don't know it, most would deny it, and a few just plain don't care and don't want to be bothered. But the feeling is there, and it's our biggest problem. Change is occurring, but it's occurring slowly, and it doesn't happen by itself. It happens only if we make it happen, and that is exactly what we're doing, making it happen. We're making it happen, often to the anger and consternation of the professionals, and sometimes to the confusion and bewilderment of the public. But we're doing it. Regardless of the consequences, we're doing it. And we're going to keep right on doing it That is what the National Federation of the Blind is all about. There was a time when we did not know our identity, when we settled for second-class citizenship, but that time is finished. Never again. There are blind people in this room and sighted allies too who will take to the streets and fight with their bare hands if they must to prevent it. We know who we are and we won't go back. On this last night of my presidency, as I recall the past and look to the future, I think of a letter which symbolizes the spirit of what we are as a movement and speaks to the special relationship which we have developed through the years. It was 1974, and we were going to Cincinnati to demonstrate against NAC. Many of you will remember it. Some of the Kentuckians were troubled about the thought of picketing and wrote to ask exactly what they would be expected to do. I told them as follows. You say that there seems to be somewhat of a reaction to the word demonstration. As you know, I grew up in the hills of Tennessee where the waters ran clear and the loyalties deep. I doubt that any member of the Federation, either in Kentucky or anywhere else, had a more conservative upbringing than I did. Picketing, demonstrating, and everything associated with those words were foreign to me. As I said in Chicago in 1972, I had never participated in a demonstration in my life, never, that is, before NAC. For that matter, I still regard myself as a conservative citizen, but I cannot stand by and do nothing while NAC remains unreformed and while I have life and strength. NAC represents tyranny to the blind. That means tyranny to the blind of Kentucky as well as to the blind of other places. It is that simple, and we cannot avoid our responsibility by telling ourselves that it does not exist. In the days of the youth of our nation, a man named Andrew Jackson went down the Mississippi to fight the British at New Orleans. The backbone of his army consisted of Kentucky riflemen straight from the edge of the frontier. They were not radicals or irresponsible hellraisers, but they would die and be double damned before they would give up their freedom to the British. I am not Andrew Jackson, and today's Kentuckians are not the frontiersmen of the 1800s. But if we meekly bow to NAC, we will deserve the second-class status we will surely get. You ask me what is expected of those attending the NAC demonstration, and I reply that we need every man, woman, and child we can get to go to the Barclay Americana May 30 to serve as a visible reminder to the NAC board members that we are free and not inferiors, that we are not indifferent, not unconcerned, and not afraid to stand up for our rights. This is what we need. But I would not want a single person to go to that meeting who is unwilling in his or her heart to go. We need frontline soldiers. But the army we need must be an army of volunteers, not draftees. We want no person there in body only. He can bring his heart with him or stay at home. You ask what is expected. You ask what is expected of Kentucky, and I answer that I want you to come as your fathers came, with the spirit that crossed the mountains, settled the wilderness, and fought the British. Do it, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against us. Let me hasten to add that the Kentuckians came to that demonstration, and so did hundreds of others from throughout the country. So it has been over the years, and so it will continue to be until we achieve our goals. When NAC arrives in Portland this summer and Phoenix this fall, we will be there to meet them. We will also be wherever else there is injustice and discrimination against the blind, or an opportunity to make new achievements, in the halls of Congress, in the state capitol buildings, in the television studios, in the newspaper offices, in the boardrooms of the agencies, in the establishments of commerce, in the classrooms of the universities, in the luncheons of the civic groups, and on the streets and the sidewalks. We are the blind speaking for ourselves, and no force on earth will stay our progress. And now I come to the hardest part of all. To my final words as president. For 25 years, I have held office in the Federation. Tomorrow night, that comes to an end. I believe the new president we have elected will lead strongly and well. As I leave the presidency, I go with the knowledge that our future is bright. It is true that there are problems to be solved and challenges to be met, that the public must be enlightened and the agencies reformed. But we are on the road, and we have already come far on the journey. We must see it in perspective. As I said last year, it is not that our situation is worse or our problems greater today than in former times. Far from it. It is only that we have become aware that our level of expectation has risen. In other days, we would hardly have noticed, and even if we had, we would not have been organized to communicate or prepared to resist. We have it better now than we have ever had it before, and tomorrow yearns with promise. As we make our advance and set our daily skirmish lines, we come to the fight with gladness, not with cringing or fear. We come with a song on our lips and joy in our hearts. For we have seen the vision of hope and felt the power of federationism and self-belief. We're organized and moving forward. We will be free, and the sighted will accept us as partners and equals. On this note, I leave the presidency. You have supported and comforted and loved me in a way that few people have ever experienced. And in turn, I have loved you. And I have sought, with all the wisdom and capacity I possess, to lead you wisely and well, together we have built dreams and marched to the battlefield. Together we have constructed a mighty movement and brought better lives to the blind. My brothers and my sisters, the future is ours. Come, let us join our new president on the barricades, and we will make it all come true.